Okay, I want to ask you a question. The recordings of the Shiurim that you have, do they remain with you for a while?
One, I save them until they get put on YU Torah, and
Okay, God bless, because we're having difficulty here. Yomo doesn't have access right now. We have to arrange it. And we're in an entirely new situation now.
you're in the classroom.
I'm in the classroom, and we've worked all morning. It's beyond words, because what's good for Rabbi Bednash is not good for me. He teaches standing, and I teach sitting, and it's a big difference. But okay, nichyeh v'nireh, and we shall overcome. Charlie, good to see you. How are you? It's been a rough while, and we're still not out of it. Although I understand that the statistics are slightly better, there are less serious cases here now. Halavai, it should continue that way. All right, we can begin. I'm ready to roll, Morty.
Okay, let me, you're for ready, one second. Let me start the recording.
This meeting being...
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, August 31st, 2020. We opened up the year yesterday, and once again, I want to state to the fellows in the Kollel who are listening or will be listening, I don't have a classroom. I don't have an organized list. I will not know who's what. If you need supplementary rabbinic credit, please be sure that Sherry knows that you're listening and that you'll be eligible for the credit at the end of the semester. Just a few minutes of introduction about this class. Kollel began, as I said yesterday, in 1978 with a formal program. Mark Wiener from Chicago was correct. There were four students came over originally in 76. That was to pacify Mr. Gross, but there was no formal program yet. 2 years later, the formal program began, and it began with the class as we began yesterday, response to literature, etc. By the way, the Sunday class was very much in consonance with Mr. Gross's thinking that we would do original work here. Meaning, as you know, over the decades, those that have followed my Sunday class, it's a combination of learning and Bernard Revel Graduate School. It's broader than simply taking a Shelet and Shuvat and looking at them simply for the halacha. About a year later, the fellows in the Kollel pressed me. I remember I had Tuesday afternoon opening. I don't know how I had the energy to do all that teaching. But when you're younger, you're younger. I look at my daughters and I see how they run around, and they're not youngsters in my eyes, but nevertheless, they're a lot younger than I am. So they pressed me to give a second course. They wanted something outside of pure learning. So either in 79 or 80, I began teaching about the Rav. I remember I spent 22 years on the Rav. I spent 4 years on a survey course of Matan Torah history, 10 years on questions students have asked me. And right now I'm working on one of the areas that I got involved because of my students, Das Torah. I'm working on a major paper at this moment in time. The Rebbeinu Shlomo should give strength, writing away with material that eyes have not yet seen. Ani modeh l'Kadosh Baruch Hu. Must be, I would make an estimate about 9, 10 years ago now, my mother took ill, and I learned at the same time that Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein is seriously ill. And somehow it shattered me, because until that point, even though I was over 70, I never realized my age. I always figured I'm a kid. You have a mother, you have Aaron, I grew up with the babe. And I said, you know something, I better stop fooling around and I better teach what I know. because there's certain areas that I don't know how many other people in the world are capable of giving these type of shiurim. So I began the history of Torah in the Western world. Some of you have been with me for all these last 9, 10 years, and you know how we began all the way back, 1886, Eitz Chaim, and we've come down until today. And we're picking up exactly where we left off. And I just want to say a word of dedication. Yesterday we dedicated the shiur in memory of Rav Atten Steinsaltz. Today, I want to dedicate the shiur in memory of Harav Dov Keller, Telza Rosh Yeshiva of Chicago. What's interesting with all the eulogies for Rabbi Keller, no one picked up the YU angle, which is extremely fascinating and really is an overture to some of the work we'll be doing this term, Be'ezrat HaNotein LeYov Koach. And when I came to the yeshiva now, Chaim Dov Keller died at the age, I believe, of 89, so he's seven years older than I am. But nevertheless, the story was legendary. Everyone in the yeshiva knew him as Henry Keller. We didn't know him as Harav Chaim Dov. He was very close to Rabbi, at the time, without rabbi, without titles, Normie Lamb. As a matter of fact, they dormed together. And then came the junior year of Yeshiva College, and this is literally right after World War II. It's an overture to what we're going to talk about. And the dean's reception. And the dean's reception was your third year in college. The dean has a reception with a bit of a buffet, and you bring your girlfriend. So in the 1930s into the 40s, who questioned this? What's wrong? A third-year college student brings his girlfriend, his date. Ein b'zeshem chisaron. But by the mid-late 40s, there's a new America. And there was an outcry. What's going on? They're bringing in the kavers, Freuen, Meidlach in the yeshiva. It's a tremendous machlekes. The Rav took the position that it's, I remember this was quoted in his name time and again, besser ze zon sich treffen in the yeshiva than af dem gas. Better that the boys and girls should meet in the yeshiva than on the streets. Anyway, the dean's reception was on, and Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller, in anger, after 3 years of college, left the yeshiva, went to Telz, and never returned. And later in life, I need not tell you, he went to Telz in Cleveland. We'll talk about it, but it went off the map. The one in Chicago, and to a lesser degree in Riverdale, they became the centers. And he joined the faculty in 1960, became one of the most formidable faculty members, a member of the Metzik Doliat Torah. And I need not tell you, a great critique of YU and Rabbi Lamb, etc. At every opportunity he spoke at Agudat Yisrael against the yeshiva, against Rabbi Lamb, against centrist orthodoxy. And it all goes back to the dean's reception. But he was an Adam Gadol, and a fabulous Rebbe. People tell me about him with understanding of students and empathy. And Yehei Zichro Baruch. Okay, now let me begin. And what I have to say is very important. It goes beyond this particular shiur as well, but it's right in place now. Years ago, I was dealing with Rav Aaron Cutler at Lakewood. And I'm excited from a book by a Talmud of his from the Dershowitz family, Rabbi Yitzchak Dershowitz, Zichrono Livracha. And I got very angry and I used the word, he's a liar. I later apologized to his son who came over to me in America. And the other day I got a letter from Mendel Lerman. I don't know what Lerman family, but I went to school with Lermans. Could very well be this is a son or grandson of my classmates. And once again, they critiqued me for using the word liar. And I apologize, I was too sharp. And I'm happy to apologize. But let me explain myself. I grew up in YU, I grew up in the lap of the Rav. Intellectual honesty was bred in me at a very early age. It hurts me when people lie. I don't know what's accomplished by it, because I always say, when you lie once, you're going to lie 1,000 times over. Das fährt auf der Dummkeit in the Mensch. It's something that goes into your body, and to lie, terrible, terrible. And unfortunately, the Haredi world has developed a certain approach that I can quote one of their experts who had the audacity to say it to me ear to ear. We don't want the students to know the truth. We want them to know what we believe will help them. Well, if you go with that approach, you can take all of Torah history and every second word will be incorrect. Now, you see this particularly in Art Scroll, and I can give you many examples. You take the Art Scroll books on Rav Shmuel Shrofol here, from Mr. Shraga Feivel Mendelovich. There is absolutely no mention of Rabbi Revel of YU. The tide was turned in America by Yeshiva Teitz Chaim, Yeshiva Rabin Yitzchok Chanan, and you're going to have all the criticisms in the world to YU today. It may very well be YU has terrible problems. Forget about the corona, what I spoke about right after Pesach, if my first shiur back, why corona, why is God doing this to us? This same-sex marriage, lesbian, homo, the whole attitude, the normal, normative, 300,000 same-sex marriages in the United States already, that the figure was given to me by Yitzchak Dershowitz's cousin, my neighbor, Dr. Sam Dershowitz. It's the end of the world. And could you imagine homos and lesbians, Shomrei Shabbos, marching uptown campus and now filing right before Corona, days before, an official complaint against Yeshiva University that they're not being treated fairly, and the university gets hundreds of millions of dollars of federal funding, state funding, etc. And part of that funding is you have to treat everyone fairly, regardless of sexual origins or sexual compulsions or whatever word they use. Okay. You have a right to criticize. It could be that you can't have a yeshiva and a university under one roof today. It could be my cousin Rabbi Rebel had a great idea 100 years ago, but 100 years later we have corona and the world is going under, and it's a different world with abortions and same-sex and euthanasia and all that goes with it, and all that a dummy like Rakefet spoke about in that first year after Pesach. But why you turn the soil? Be honest. And you see that too when Teira Vadas just celebrated 100 years. They came out with a beautiful, what do they call it, a coffee table top book. And it was given to me a gift. I was on a beautiful book. No mention of YU, no mention of Rabbi Rebel, Rakefet Aron, Chelik Dalid, look what I published, the Modat Evel, remember I gave a whole shiur on it, of Torah Vadas when Rabbi Rebel died, give credit. And I have to tell you, Torah Vadas was punished for leaving out YU. Why? The first time you see a picture of a YU graduate, I think it's on page 265 in this coffee table volume, I don't want to mention his name. All I'll tell you is they showed him he was head of an institution in Israel against abortions. I think it was called Just One Life, and Teira Vadas graduates were contributing. And here is this man's picture. He's no longer alive. Don't want to say an extra word. All I can tell you is he was on the front page of the New York Times many times in the last 20 years. And Hamevin Yavin. And that's the first picture I show everyone here. That's where YU's introduced. There's the connection that it's a punishment for not telling the truth. Now, with Reb Aaron Cutler, what happened was book after book comes out. And they describe Reb Aaron's sister as being religious, but a Mizrahiite. And that's why I got semi-hysterical, as much as I'm inclined to be, but to use the word liar, I apologize, because they're coming from a world where you're taught to lie. I'm coming from a world where, yes, this is a lie. And this is absolutely not correct. Rav Aaron's sister wanted him to come to Moscow University. Rav Aaron, according to what I heard when I learned in Lakewood, early 50s, Rav Aaron already was on the bus, and Rav Reuven Grzebski pulled them off with miracles, etc. And you minimize Rav Aaron Cutler. You see, that was a period, Rav Aaron's only sibling, Malka, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, not one sibling remained from. Yes, out of one sibling, grandchildren, Chazru B'tshuva, became a prominent Orthodox family in the Midwest. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, not one sibling. You start to understand the Rebbe, you understand what these people went through. So it's to their kavod that you describe it honestly. Look what they had to overcome. Time and again I've told you, and Esther, you should appreciate this, we grew up in the Bronx. There were 700,000 Jews in the Bronx when I grew up. If you could find a minyan Shomer Shabbos between the ages of 21 to 65, it was a miracle. 700,000 plus Jews. Well, tell the truth, tell the truth. I just went through an art scroll book on Rav Chaim Isaac Rishinsky. It's beyond words. They leave you with the impression that he was in favor of taking the visas of Sampo Sugiharo and going and telling the communists you want to leave and traveling to Japan. And this is, it takes away the whole story. This is a movie that has to be made one day of the tremendous tension of the Miri Yeshiva boys. This was all related to me the first time, 1949, 1950, Rabbi Gershon Yankelevich, Rabbi Henich Fishman, Zichronim Tzadikim Levracha, and to make a decision to leave, and Rabbi Chaim Moshe was opposed, and the Mashgiach was opposed. What tension, what a story. But tell the truth. Prepare someone for life. Okay, why am I telling you all this? Because time and again, I've been asked this question 1,000 times over, because Baruch Hashem, in the Haredi world, I do have a reputation for intellectual honesty, and some of my books have been read and reread and reread and quoted and cited. And I can mention the Novominsko, who just died in of Corona, lo aleinu. He was a, I'm a chassid of his, and he was a chassid of mine. He said things about me in public that, believe me, I don't know why you, if they speak so positive. So time and again, they call me, was there any Yiddishkeit in America before World War II? And you should know, there are many people walking around who really, honestly believe there was nothing in America. The immigrants, the survivors, they did it all. And this is not true whatsoever. And here let me put into context one of the funniest stories I can tell you. I've written many letters in my life. I've answered many questions. I never wrote a letter like this. It goes back to the early 70s, and you have to remember the young people who came to Israel at that time were either college graduates or juniors. You didn't come. The whole concept of post-high school began after the Yom Kippur War. So when I started teaching, in this happened in Mahon Gold in 71. Remember, I started at the Encyclopedia of 69, BMT 69. 71, I returned to teaching full-time. When I started teaching in Mahon Gold, my students were kalak at the age of getting married. I actually made some shidduchim myself that exist until today. Among my students, I don't have one divorce. Among outsiders, one or two, but not among students. This girl comes to me, a nice girl, fine girl, and this young man is interested in her, and his parents are going crazy. My high, He was second generation, a survivor. Parents were survivors. He was born after the war. Parents wound up in Borough Park in Brooklyn. And this girl, her parents were already in America in the 1920s, or her grandparents. And the parents of the boy were hysterical that chas v'chalila, she's a bat nida. There were no mikvot in America before 1940, 39. That's what his parents believed. And they came to me, and I wrote a letter, as I already was right when Rebbe was published, so it had to be 72. And with the publishing of Bernard Rebbe, Leader of American Jewish Orthodoxy, so people knew I knew a little bit about history. I had a doctorate. I've published a book, JPS. It was a big thing at the time. And I wrote a letter, would you believe it, Dov, certifying that there were mikvahs before the Rabbi Zakheim brothers got to America. And on the basis of my letter, his parents allowed them to get engaged. So this is the first point, and married, and I trust it's now three, they can have great-grandchildren already. It's so many years later. I trust the marriage worked out. But this is the point I want to make, and it's very important. Before World War II, there was some Torah in the Western world. The basis was there, but there's no question that with World War II, the refugees, the survivors, the entire picture of Torah in the Western world went on to a different footing, a different level, and we are all part of that until this very moment. And let me begin at the beginning. What am I referring to? America, we saw, took a time. Rabbinate grew up capable of speaking the American language. Rabbis Young, Lookstein, Goldstein, Drachman, totally at home in the American society, the American environment. And these people were able to command respect, Balabatim, among them wealthy Balabatim, Harry Fischel, Nathan Lamport, Mendel Gottesman, just to give a few examples. And there was something. Rabbi Soloveitchik already started teaching in the yeshiva in 1941, a new level, Bris, PhD, Berlin. But there's no question that these people were at home and satisfied. This is America. This is the reality. This is the Western world. The new wave that came in totally changed the picture, the state, the commitment, the value system of what orthodoxy or Torah was about in the Western world. More than that, they influenced each and every religious Jew, including every one of us until today. And this will become apparent as we go on. I want to give you some sources and develop it a little further. Now, I'm quoting from an MA thesis by Joel Kortnik, Kortik, Kortock. This MA thesis was written at the Hebrew U, 1996. It's an MA thesis. There's no chidushim here, but it's very well organized with historic material. It's exactly what an MA thesis should be. And evidently this Joel, let me get his name again, Kortik, who I don't know, never met, but evidently Lubavitch had an influence on him, and he did his MA thesis, Transformation and Rejuvenation. the arrival in America of Chabad and other Orthodox Jewish communities, 1940 to 1950. And I want to discuss the SEMA thesis and take this information, which is well organized, and put it on the table. Yes, the late 1930s, something happened which never happened before. I write about it in the Suva era. Yours truly, my grandparents came to America 120 years ago. My wife's family, on her mother's side, their origins in America are from the 1870s. Malka has great-great-grandparents buried in Queens in Mount Hebron Cemetery. These people came to America. Believe me, they knew that they're risking the Torah future. You came to America, the Treifalan, the Golden of Medina, and who knows what will be with your children, your grandchildren. And these people came nevertheless. Certainly in my case, in Malka's case, some of our grandparents were tzaddikim 100%, but they willingly took on this danger. Could be they had to. Panasa, sakonet nefashot, communism, fascism, better to be in America. By the mid-30s, late-30s, you have Jews coming to America not by choice, but because they had no choice. They had to get away, they had to save their lives, they had to leave Europe, and these people already came with a different Bren, a different gestalt, a different commitment. We're not going to lose our Judaism. Halavai, we didn't have to come. Halavai, we don't have to be in America. But if we're going, we have to be sure that we retain our Yiddishkeit. And this goes right down the line. You can take Kehillah after Kehillah. We'll say a few words about each one. Reb Aaron Kotler, the Litvaken, the Satmar, the Bavava, the Washington Heights German community, they resolved America will be no different. And to a certain degree, they absolutely succeeded. And here, I want to quote to you, how did the Americanized rabbis who were lamdanim and successful, they were not overjoyed. It was difficult for them. And we have a classic name, again today, time has moved on, so I mention Rabbi Dr. Oscar Fasman, F-A-S-M-A-N. Only those of you from Chicago will recognize the name. Rabbi Fasman was the head of Skokie, what you call Skokie today, Hebrew Theological College, Beit Medrash LaTorah, whatever name you know Chicago by. And Rabbi Fasman, this was a man who worshipped the ground that Rabbi Soloveitchik walked on. And I'm quoting, he published later, I quote him quite often because he spoke about it openly. As the spokesman of this new wave of Rashi Yeshiva were brought into the classroom of the American institutions, they influenced a violent spirit of negativism towards every manifestation of modern civilization. Wherever possible, they discouraged the students from enrolling at any colleges, or if they found their disciples required higher education to earn a living, accounting and mathematics were becoming popular fields for Orthodox Jews. It was clearly spelled out that only the skill should be pursued, but the values should be expunged forever from the mind. And I need not tell you, This is a classic statement and absolutely correct. Before 1940, who spoke against college? The Malachim, go back to what I taught you in the history of Torah, Teira V'Das. The Malachim were thrown out of Teira V'Das because they had the audacity to speak against college. Whoever went to Chaim Berlin, whoever went to Teira V'Das, you went to Brooklyn College. It was a natural. Brooklyn, later Queens, City College, endless Orthodox Jews getting an education beyond the yeshiva training. And now, for the first time, you have Rashi Yeshiva. I need not tell you. Absolute negative feeling for college, for university. I can recall myself hearing Rabbi Aaron Cutler quoting the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Gemara in Chelek, Dava Hashem Bazah. You're insulting God if you waste your time on secular studies. And you see, Rabbi Fassman was offended by this. Now, in his own life, I don't know his own entire family, but I can tell you, his son-in-law, Rabbi Sugarman, Marvin Sugarman, was a YU Musmach, was Torah and Mada, and his own son, when I learned in Lakewood, his son was one of the top Talmidim, remained a Lakewood supporter, a Lakewood Talmud. I believe they opened up a kollel afterwards in Los Angeles. That was the son of Rabbi Fassman. So you see how the trend, the tide, the sinking, the sand, the atmosphere, it's starting to shift gears. It's not the same America. And for Haraya, you take Agudat Yisrael. I write about this in the Silver Era. Try to organize Agudat Yisrael in America in 1922. It fell flat on its face. All right, could be someone's going to find there was an address, Agudat Yisrael, Lower East Side. They're going to say Rakefet doesn't know what he's talking about. Yes, there was an address, there were a handful of members, etc. Never took off. The late 30s, when Reb Lezer Silva comes back from the Knesiyah Gedolah in Marienbad, 1937, and turns to Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, by 1938, plane loads of Jews in Hasidic clothing and Litvisha clothing are flying out to Cincinnati for the first convention of Agudat Yisrael on American soil. And it absolutely took off, a different clientele. The 1920s, the 1930s, there was one Agudist in all of America. It was a cousin, Rabbi Chaim Isaac Grzynski. It was Rabbi Grzynski of Omaha, Nebraska. They say that this Rabbi Grzynski, later he retired, he lived in Brooklyn, he was involved in the slaughterhouse, Hakshirim, he made a living that way. They say he knew every Rashi and Tosfot and Shas by heart. And he was in Omaha, Nebraska. And he was an Agudist. He was a cousin of Reb Chaim Moshe Grzynski. Everyone else, even Reb Lezer Silva, when he organized Agudat Yisrael at the Reb Chaim Moshe's behest, even Reb Lezer, I just quoted it to someone this morning from my work, I gave him the exact page, Reb Lezer said publicly, Agudat Yisrael is my older sister and Mizrahi is my youngest sister. But after 1940, wow, Mizrahi in America disappears. All right, there are good reasons why it disappears. All its devotees go in Aliyah. Just think who Mizrahi produced for the State of Israel, beginning with Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, etc. I can go one by one. Giants who left America and what they accomplished in Israel knew there was no one left in America. But if you stay in Brooklyn, and you stay in Flatbush, and you stay in Borough Park, Baruch Hashem, one generation, two generations, three generations, Agudat Yisrael, although who knows, this is all shifting gears now. I hear stories of people who never dreamt they're coming on Aliyah from good places in Brooklyn and elsewhere, and they're already registered with Nefesh B'Nefesh. I know it from families that I'm very close to. So it could be this is shifting gears now, but beginning with the late 30s, it's a different America. And here, you take someone like Nathan Bulman, Nachman Bulman. Again, I apologize to you. To me, he's a living reality sitting right next to me. I knew Nathan quite well. When he arrived in Israel, I spoke at the reception for him. I was the main speaker. Welcome him. Nachman Bulman, very fascinating person. Talmud Chacham, Yorei Shalem, broad-minded, succeeded in teaching B'nai Torah and outreach. He was a Talmud Mufhak of Rabbi Belkin in the 1930s. But and he was very successful in the rabbinate, I think I've told you more than once, he was Mashpia on the Hain family. They had four sons. And all four sons came to various schools in Talmudical Academy, Yeshiva College, all at once. It made big publicity. And those four boys, each one became a giant. The elder one, Lo Aleinu, was gone. Jimmy was one year behind me in class, was a very famous dentist from, he was in New Jersey. Then there was Danny, who was head of nuclear medicine at Shaare Tzedek, should live and be well, my good friend, my children's good friend. And then Kenny Hain, the rabbi of Lawrence, and then the youngest brother who wound up going to B'nai Brak, I guess after high school, I don't think he went to college yet. And he never left, went into the Chazon Ish Kolel, and he's there until today. And this is all the result of Rabbi Nathan Boom and Kanai and Hari. You can't count how many grandchildren and great-grandchildren, they're all on Atmat HaKodesh. And Rabbi Nathan Bulman, I'm quoting, becomes active in Agudat Yisrael, and he claims, this is a public statement, that the lay orthodoxy of pre-war American Jewry has laid the groundwork for, quote, the terrible abyss which separates the new intense immigrant orthodoxy from the American Orthodox camp. And you can understand what's happening here. And some of you, your own families, I don't want to use the words that you would use, but I remember growing up, you'd have Shomer Shabbos people, and when they saw the new Frumkeit, they used the word, I don't know, repeat it, I don't consider it a nice word, but it begins something like a CH. And wow, were they turned off by what later is called the swing to the right. Now, this raised many questions. I'm quoting now from the Jewish Observer, Agudat Yisrael, 1941. And can these yeshivot function in a pragmatic, practical America? Can the Lashon Slabodka, Mir, and Kletz be transplanted to America? Could such institutions find students without offering the prospect of training for professional careers? Would there be balabatim to support them financially? And these were legitimate questions. And over the years, take a look what has happened. Lakewood Yeshiva that began with 13 students. There's a little machlokes, 13, 14, or 15. But let's say 13. There are lists of the original students. Some of them I knew. Chaim, Snow, Vic, you're related to one of the original guys. I don't know if it's direct or by marriage, but it's your brother, your sister works into that family. Anyway, these original, look at YU at the time. Imagine someone would tell you that the day will come when Lakewood will have 6,000 students. Could you believe it? You talk about money. Yes, Reb Aaron went through hell in his lifetime. Here was the great Reb Aaron, had to go around schnurring money. By the way, that's why we owe a tremendous thank you to Reb Shmuel Belkin, to Dr. Samuel Belkin. Professor Green, I think you knew Dr. Belkin. We owe a tremendous thank you to him because he enabled the Rav to become the Rav. He said to the Rav, Vic Yeller quotes this in his book, in his memoir, he said to the Rav, Ich verteigen in verfahr de Geld, I'll take care of the money aspects, you just concern yourself with the students. But take a look today, before Corona, Corona has changed the whole world, but before Corona, tell me, who was wealthier? Who was on a more secure financial basis? Lakewood or Yeshiva University? And I have news for you. The answer is absolutely Lakewood. Aaron Cutler, the CEO of Lakewood, a financial genius. Oh, you should see what they own, what they have, what their plans for, how they work, how they're computerized. Why you? Doesn't equal it. So these questions that they asked 70, 80 years ago, now you look back, perhaps one of the greatest success stories, how these immigrants came to America and changed the entire tide, the entire theme, the entire rhythm of Torah in the Western world. And I'll give you more sources soon. Now, what happened in America, the first European yeshiva to literally be transplanted to America was Tells. Tells is a very interesting story, and some people have it wrong. I read here it's incorrect too. Whoever worked with this thesis should have corrected it. What happened with Tells is not that two brothers-in-law, Reb Mutta Katz, Reb Mordechai Katz, and Reb Elia Meir Bloch. I can't go into all the details. I will when I deal with the Tells Yeshiva Be'ezrat Hashem. When I deal with Eastern Europe, the Eibishter should give me many more years. I need them just to teach what I know. So these were brothers-in-law. They came to America to raise funds for Tells. That saved their lives. Reb Metal Katz, I think his wife, 10 children, I think, plus a daughter was born that he never saw after he left Europe, all wiped out by Hitler. Rav Bloch's family partially wiped out. God have mercy on us. Just to mention it brings tears to my eyes. I knew their families. I knew particularly Rav Mutl Katz, his family living in Katamon, not far from me. And they were stranded. And they wound up, it's not that they came to America to open a branch of Tells, but because they were stranded and they learned what was happening in Europe, they opened up a branch of Tells in Cleveland. Why Cleveland? Cleveland, from the 30s on, was searching for Yeshiva Gavoha. There was an element there. Ne Yisrael was in Cleveland for a while. There was an element there that wanted a yeshiva gavoha. And with the brothers-in-law, they were offered the Rabbi Revel, who was the only yeshiva ever learned in for one semester. He was autodidactic, was Tells. He offered them full-time positions, Rabbi Bloch, Rabbi Katz. No, they wanted to recreate Tells. And They began Tells in Cleveland. You don't realize it today, but in the 50s, the 60s, that was a tremendous pull. Some of the brightest kids from all over America, I'll give you a simple example. Those of you who remember Aaron Bat, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. Aaron Bat, where did he go off to high school? He went to Taos. The pool was so great. It went into the suburbs. It built an entire campus. The stone money. It was a beautiful shidduch, Yisachar and Zvulun. And Nebuch, because it was a Litvashi yeshiva, you had to marry the right girl to teach. It's not like why you were a dummy like Rakefet can teach away and teach away, because it's nothing to do with marrying into YU. It has to do with your own abilities and creating students, Kanayin Hara. All right, today, many decades later, I found out I have more Yichus than anyone walking around the YU campus, a blood relative of Rabbi Bernard Reffel, Nuke, Ein Kleinigkeit. But no one knew that until a few years ago, including myself. So Tells in Cleveland went under. They didn't have the quality. But the branches that were built in Chicago, as I mentioned, and in Riverdale are very important Torah institutions today, particularly in Chicago. Tells is a shame dava. And this was the first yeshiva. Now, it was different than Lakewood. Lakewood, again, a guy like Rakefet will always tell you, what is the real name of Lakewood Yeshiva? Slutz, Kletz, Lakewood. Yes, it began in Slutz, 1896, in White Russia. But in America, it wasn't a direct continuation. Rabbi, what happened in America, I have to be very brief, was that when all these Gedolim came in, they have to find employment, they have to find satisfaction. So in White Plains, they opened a little kollel with Reb Mendel Zaks. And it didn't take off. When Reb Aaron, when the Hatzalah work finished in 43, when it was obvious you couldn't save another Jew, so then Reb Aaron, they pleaded with him, open up a yeshiva. Reb Aaron was a Bren, was a Shane Dover, and he was younger. And then he decided Lakewood. He didn't call it Kletzk, he didn't call it Sklutsk. Lakewood, Beit Medrash Gavoha. So that's a new yeshiva. Technically, I'm right. It began in Slutsk, Reb Aaron, then it had to move to Kletzk, away from the communists, and then it winds up in Lakewood. But it was an entirely new institution. Unlike Tells, where they prided themselves, we are the American branch of the real, true, accurate Tells yeshiva. Then, Mir. The Mir story is very important. As I say, I'm writing about it now with the whole question of Shanghai and Semple Sugihara Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Mir survived with unbelievable miracles. At the end of the war in Shanghai, 46, 47, every last student had to make a decision, La'an. Mir already had reopened in Yerushalayim, Reb Lazy Yehuda Finkel, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, and Mir had reopened in New York, Reb Avram Kalmanovich, and there was Reb Chatzkel Levenstein at the time, although then he comes to Palestine, Israel actually. And students had to decide. So some of the students went to Israel. Many went to the United States. And those of you who lived the period, remember the period, they were called the old bachelors, the Elter Amira. No one was married. They were late 20s, early 30s. They had gone through the war. All right, there were a few who were married in Shanghai, absolutely, actually, with women who had come, women they knew, women they were engaged to. But most were not married. So first, Atman Gedaf Machen Shidduchim. I still remember the marriages of some of my Rebbeim. Then they had to find jobs. And these Mira wound up teaching Torah all over the United States in day schools. And Rabbi Rubin will testify, the mirror who came to Maimonides, it gave the Rav such a boost, it gave Maimonides such a boost. What can I tell you? I write about it in Washington. I can't do any better than what I wrote about. In seventh grade already, my Rebbe didn't speak a word of English, and I didn't speak a word of Yiddish, Reb Geshen Yankelevich. My mother named him Jackson, Rabbi Jackson, Yankelevich, Yankel. So my mother used to say, how is Rabbi Jackson? And the later in life, I come to know Jacksons that play a big role with the Russian Jewry, and they become Ben Yaakov, and they're part of my family. They're married grandchildren, are married to my brother's grandchildren. And so Yankelevich has gone from Yankelevich to Jackson. Jackson already I know from England, and here in Israel, Baruch Hashem, Ben Yaakov. Jackson, my mother was right. Reb Henoch Fishman, the influence that these Rebbeim had all over the day schools in Detroit, in Chicago, wherever there were day schools, in Boston, in New York, you cannot imagine the impact. And I can say, if I'm sitting here, let me be honest, I was an American kid, the American dream, American parents, and a medical doctor. I was accepted into Bronx High School of Science. They're so stupid. For 4 years, they sent me letters as if I'm a student there. And it's Reb Henoch Fishman who insisted I go to MTA. He's like, noch nicht warten. Man darf noch lernen. No, man kann gehen zur Universität nachher. Aber jetzt darf man lernen. Man darf lernen, wie zu lernen. Now is your time to learn how to learn. It's Reb Henoch Fishman. He kept me, I don't know, I hope I would have gone to Bronx Science, I would have been a from Jew, but I hope I would have been a great doctor, it's an important profession, but a Lamdin Velechev I wouldn't be, a Talmud Chacham I wouldn't be, etc. So, you see, this impact you cannot minimize. Then you have to deal with Washington Heights. Nowadays, I met someone, the butcher's daughter from Washington Heights. What was the butcher's name? Hyman? Charlie? Give me the name later, the butcher in Washington Heights. Hyman, and there was a partner, Fleischman, something like that. Baruch HaTor Adonai L'mel Necholam Shakol Niyam Yerom. She's the secretary to Dr. Orbach. She runs this office. So she told me who her parents were. She said, Rabbi Riskin, when he found out she lives in Efrat, that was your father, the best davush. They made the best salamis, the best hot dogs. Oh, I can see Charlie's laughing. But you see, many Germans had come to Washington, had come to America before. Germans started running away to Israel in the 1920s, Rehavia. They started running away to America, the Upper West Side. These Germans were basically assimilated, irreligious. I don't have to tell you the assimilation in Germany. It never achieved the heights that we have, lo aleinu, in America, where the candidate for vice president is married to a Jew, and his children from his first wife call her what? Mamala. And this is their Yiddishkeit. Gutzal up hitten. What an example. But this is American Jewry. And Washington Heights already, oh boy, this was a different level. And the fact that Rabbi Breuer came, and Rabbi Breuer was determined to have a kehillah not any different than Frankfurt. He built the kehillah. It's not that he took over an existing kehillah, but he wrote the blueprint, built it, structured it with his own two hands. And here's a description. These immigrants associated with the Breuer community differed strongly from other German immigrants to the United States during the same period. Those of the Breuer community of Washington Heights were less wealthy, less intellectual, less assimilated, but much more religiously observant. The German Jewish refugees of the pre-World War II period were strictly a refugee community. They did not come to America voluntarily, but rather to escape severe Nazi persecution. And I think that says it all. And you all know that community went on, right? It has a long life. The community today is went into suburbia, a part of Muncie, part of Teaneck, part of Englewood. The community itself in Washington Heights is a victim of what's happened to the inner cities. But nevertheless, they've left the lasting impact. A good deal of Lakewood. What's fascinating is the majority of the community chose Lakewood over Yeshiva University. And it's an interesting question that one can lecture on for hours. But they played their role in developing Torah on the American scene. And then you have to come back to Reb Aaron Cutler. What's most unique about Reb Aaron Cutler, and as you know, Rabbi Moshe Meiselman wrote a famous article in Tradition which caused a lot of feedback, in which he states, essentially, the only difference between my uncle, Mori Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, and Reb Aaron Cutler is that the Rav reached America in 1932, and Reb Aaron Cutler reached America in 1941, with the implication being, had the Rav come at the later period, he would have been as narrow as Reb Aaron Cutler. Well, that's absolutely not true. The Rav was part of the modern world, the Western world. He had gone to Berlin. No, that the Rav was a Gaon, and that Torah was the basis, and this was the heart, and this was Lithuania, and Reb Chaim was Reb Chaim. Ein man de polik. This is absolutely correct. But there was much, much more to the Rav. And you see with his descendants, some of them took only the core, only the basic part of the Rav, Rav Yitzchak Lichtenstein. Today the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas. Torah Vadas doesn't mention he's not the son of Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, he's not the grandson of the Rav. Everything comes to his wife. His wife is a Grzatsky. Her father was Reb Chaim. I learned in Lakewood with him. Reb Chaim was the son of Reb Reuven Grzatsky, who they say pulled Reb Aaron off the bus not to go to Moscow and university to join his sister. Reb Reuven Grzatsky was the son-in-law of Reb Baruch Berlebowitz. This is terrific yichus that Yitzi picked up through his wife to be Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas. You take Reb Moshe Meiselman. Part of it is the core of the Rav. Not beyond. You take Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, Reb Moshe Sala Lichtenstein, Reb Meir Lichtenstein. Ah, there you see a much broader perspective, more like the totality of the Rav. But Reb Aaron Cutler came to America and he said Torah, Torah, and only Torah. And it affected everyone. I'll give you a simple example. I'm sitting here in a classroom. This classroom is Gris Kollel. Why you today, and again, everything is before Corona, none of us know. The Ribbono Shel Olam should have mercy on us. None of us know what's going to be when this ends. But why you had Kollelim in my time? Well, tell me. Rakevet happens to be an anomaly, an anachronism. I'm the last Rosh Yeshiva appointed to the YU faculty who never learned in a kollel. When Dr. Belkin drank L'chaim with me in 1962, and Serech B'naich Mamana Rosh Yeshiva in Rosh Yeshiva S'chochanan, I'm appointing Rosh Yeshiva S'chochanan, there was no kollel. In my days, either you knew how to learn when you were 23, or you'll never know how to learn. And Baruch Hashem, I'm not complaining. The yeshiva taught me how to learn. It taught me 1% of what I know today, but it taught me how to learn, how to continue. Learning is a lifetime avocation. It's not something just your years in yeshiva, then you get smicha. Big deal, you're big amaretz, you know, a few simanim in your hadeya and a few daf gemara. You have to know 2,200 daf gemara and dalet chaltei shulchan aruch and more and more and more. Ein l'dav asov, baruch Hashem. Who had a kollel? Yes, don't correct me. I know. Why you, very few people know this. After World War II, when the immigrants came to America, the greenhorns, the griner. So Reb Shmuel Belkin, who was such a Baal Chesed and had such feeling for the Litvashi Yeshiva Bacha, which he once was, he organized the Koilel till they'll find their way on the American scene. Morty, your friends, she's a daughter of Rav Zipperstein. Rav Avigdor Zipperstein was the head of this Koilel. I can show you on Washington Heights, the building doesn't stand anymore. That's the Kollel Metna, a little building, I believe it was built by World War II money from the government to help students go back to college. A little building, that's where the Kollel met. And these were Europäische Tommy Kochen Gesitzen in Gelernt. One of them went on and got a master's degree in chemistry, Rav Peretz Posen, terrific Talmud Chacham Amira. He later joined the yeshiva faculty as a professor of chemistry. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was chemistry, not physics, but I believe it was chemistry. But these Kollel lights, some of them went on to teach in BTA. They acclimated to the American scene. Same, Oyska learned a bissel English. They learned a little bit English. This was a chesed Kollel. Then it disappeared. There was no need for it. Everyone found their way. But Lakewood and Beit Medrash Elyon and learning and Jungle Light, and it conquered America. By the 60s, why you had a kollel, two kollelim, it went into three kollelim, four kollelim. The word kollel in the United States, although technically Beit Medrash Elyon was before Lakewood, but the credit has to be given to Rav Aaron Cutler. He put standards on America that you have to rise and change, and America is no different than what we had in Lithuania. And you have to give Rav Aaron credit, he didn't remain in his Dalet Amot. To a certain degree, and I've said this many times, the Rav became the Rav in America. Rav Aaron Cutler came to America, Rav Aaron Cutler. And what do I mean? The Rav, this was due to Dr. Belkin, continued learning, read Rakefet's The Rav, read where the Rav talks about himself and why he loves Yeshiva University. And no one interfered with him. His wife carried the burden of Maimonides. The Rav had no financial burden in YU. This was all Rabbi Belkin. Ultimately, it ruined Rabbi Belkin's health, as you know. But Rabbi Belkin continued all the time financially. The Rav, your role, be machadesh. Go further, go deeper, raise talmidim. And the Rav remained within Dalet Amot. Later, he's dragged into the public sphere through Moria and the growth of RCA and OU. But the basic gestalt was the tent in Boston where he could seclude himself from the world. Rav Aaron Cutler never had a moment to really learn B'menuchat HaNefesh in America. He had to raise funds, he had to knock on doors, he had to plead with people, he had to go and raise $10 bills and $20 bills. But more than that, he went into the public atmosphere and went in begadol, not quiet. Agudat Yisrael, who put Agudat Yisrael on the map? Who was chairman of the Mo'etzet Gedolei HaTorah? Who spoke at every Agudah convention? Who raised the prestige of Agudat Yisrael? Rav Aaron Cutler. Torah Mesorah, yes. Mr. Shraga Feivel Mendelovich gets all the credit. He established Torah Mesorah, shoot off of Teira Vadas. All that is correct. But after World War II, it's Rabbi Aaron Cutler, chairman of the Rabbinic Advisory Committee to Torah Mesorah. He put it on the map. He set the standards. We'll talk about this later this term. We should reach it in health. This was Reb Aaron, and a great deal of Torah in the United States today, including Rish Kolel, you have to humbly thank Reb Aaron Cutler. This was the man, his vision. Okay. Now, but there was another world. Till now we've spoken about Litvish and learning and Torah, but there was another world, the Hasidic world. And a lot of research has been done, a lot has been written. I recommend to you highly George Kranzler, Gershon Kranzler. Any of you from Baltimore recognize the name? Rabbi Dr. Gershon Kranzler was principal of the Beis Yaakov in Baltimore. The Beis Yaakov in Baltimore was always blessed with outstanding people until today, including Charlie Hexter's own brother. There was a Rabbi Friedman there who relates to my
student. He was principal of TA, the boys' school.
The boys' school? He wasn't involved with Beis Yaakov?
No.
You sure?
Because I went there.
Okay, so then I stand corrected. But Baltimore was always blessed with great mechanchim. And am I right or wrong? Did you know Gershon Kranzler was an edler, was such a fine individual. He published a great deal on the Hasidic world. And he makes the point, their interviews with Hasidic Yidden who arrived in America, and you'll see these Hasidic Yidden say, we're not like the Hasidim who came 20, 30 years ago. They came knowing they would be Americanized. We are coming determined that America will be no different than the world we left behind. And they succeeded. Now, yes, you can. I quote to you, a Satmar from Williamsburg reported the following, I quote, this is from George Kranzler's work, The Voice of Williamsburg. As you can see, we have no generation gap here. The only generation missing here is the one that perished in the concentration camps and the ghettos. If anything, our children are even more enthusiastic in their Hasidic beliefs and have an equal, if not better, and more intensive Torah education. And there's a lot of truth to that. They went on to build, you have to stand in awe of what these greenhorns achieved on the American scene, and their success in self-perpetuating their children. I'm quoting now from Professor Michael Wishegrad, who was professor of philosophy at the City University of New York, and he describes, this is speaking at a symposium in 1982, Hasidim in New Square, Crown Heights, and Borough Park has undertaken to replicate in America the life it knew in Europe before the war. But imitation is a dangerous religious technique. The consciousness of American Hasidim is influenced by the American environment, which perhaps looms even larger when the strategy adopted for coping with it is the pretense that one has never left the villages of Poland or Hungary, and the strategy has exacted a price. European Hasidicism had a spirituality, gentleness, and inwardness. American Hasidicism is more sullen, defensive, and hard. And I have to tell you, let me just summarize this. This is a point that I've made throughout the decades. Yes, Hasidicism and Literaturism all succeeded in reconstructing themselves in America. But is it the same Litvak like the old home? Is it the same Chassid like the old home? Absolutely not. Second, third generation Herbie, they are Americanized. It's a different type of Chassid. And here, let me clue you in something I've spoken about a number of times over the decades. In the early 60s, the Rav speaking in Moriah, and Moriah, he, to a certain degree, let his hair down. Why? We saw him in Shir. It was always Shas and Paiskim and Rav Chaim. Moriah, he gave a Shir, and then he spoke on Parshat HaShavua. And many times he let off steam in Yonad Yoma. What was troubling him? America, Israel. And one time I'm listening via tape, thanks to Manny Holzer, Zichrona Levracha, saved my life with the tapes of the Rav. And Manny and the Rav develops the theme. Yes, the Hasidim tried. I know the Hasidim. I was in Warsaw. I was in Chaslovich. I saw the Hasidim. The Hasidim tried to reconstruct Europe, but they can never reach the same level of piety, of sincerity, because America influences them. Money is honey. No one wants to be poor. And the Rav, exactly, sullen, defensive, hard, and a chassid yells out from the audience in Moriah, Chassidish person, and believe me, not a poor person, in diamonds. The whole Moriah crowd were the diamond merchants from 42nd Street. And the chassid yells out, "Nein, das ist nicht richtig, it's not so, ze yohab matzliach gewen," and the Rav shoots back at him, "You want me to prove to you that I'm right? Where do your children learn? They go to YU and study with me." What does that show? They're more worldly, earthly, concerned with money, want to make a living. It's nicht dieselbe Ödemkeit, the poverty, what was in Europe, what they left behind. And I have to tell you, there's a lot of truth to this, because ultimately what happens is Satmar, and you take a square, and any other type of Hasidic movement, Bavav, they have very beautifully integrated on the American scene. They've learned what political pressure is, what hishtadlut is, what voting as a bloc means. Believe me, they've learned how to utilize the American scene, the American democracy, the local politics, to enable their Hasidic sects to flourish. So it's 100 years later, let's say, was es given 1910, 1920, in the old Alte Heim. It's not exactly the American Hasidic lifestyle, but nevertheless, you have to give credit. Hayahadut poshetet tzura v'loveshet tzura. HaChasidis poshetet tzura v'loveshet tzura. How do we say it in modern Hebrew, the aphorism? Ota geveret bishinui aderet. Okay. However, there was no greater influence on the American scene than Chabad. The story of Chabad is legendary. No greater influence on the world Jewish scene, I would say second to the State of Israel. The second greatest influence on the world Jewish scene is Chabad. Chabad itself, how do you picture it? where does it stand? And this is fascinating. Chabad, you cannot classify them. Are they Haredim? Are they Matan Orthodox? Are they more inclined towards a Satma lifestyle or more inclined to a Western lifestyle? Chabad is an absolute unique world to itself. And they are elements of all aspects of the Torah world you will find cloistered together, working hand in hand by Chabad. And this all goes back to the sixth Rebbe. The sixth Rebbe had one advantage that the Satmar didn't have, that the Square didn't have, that the Bhagavad didn't have. The sixth Rebbe visited the Western world, spent a year here, 1928-1929. He toured all of America. He was raising funds, he raised substantial funds. All of you know that Chabad worked around the clock when the Russians took over, the communists, the God have mercy, anti-religion, exile, Siberia, execution. He worked around the clock trying to save Jews and Judaism in Greater Russia. But while he was raising the funds, he was a young man at the time in the prime of life, 1928-1929, he saw what America is all about. He was in Philadelphia, he was in Chicago, he was in Montreal, he was in Toronto. You can go city by city, the Rebbe was all over. When he came to America, running away from Hitler, he did not come an ignoramus. He came fully cognizant of what he was coming into. And here's the famous story, I've told it many times, his arrival. And my wife's own relatives were there at the port to greet him. There were ads in all the newspapers. If anyone holds Chabad near and dear, come to the port. The Rebbe's arriving to live in America, escaping the communists, the Nazis. And there were about 5,000 Jews. The absolute minority was Shomer Shabbos. These were Jews that grew up in Chabad. Remember, Hasidim have an emotional attachment. This is one of the great challenges to us as Mechanchim in Israel, and I hope the younger Mechanchim listening to me, if we don't give the children in our school systems an emotional attachment to Yiddishkeit, they feel the romance of Yiddishkeit, it's very dangerous, because then they can leave it very easily. The pull, the depth, the emotion is not there. It's not just enough intellectual. It has to be much deeper. It has to take the entire soul and body. So these people came to the pier, and someone began a Hasidic niggun, and everyone joined in. People were crying, and men went home, and they swore they would never again be Mechallel Shabbos. And that's what I told you, remember, it's not a joke. That women said, no, you want to be Shomer Shabbos, but I have a 10 o'clock appointment at the beauty parlor since 1929. I'm not going to give up that slot. 10 o'clock Shabbos morning, everyone went to the beauty parlor. Of course, Saturday night, you went out to the Palace Theater to the theaters were, the movies. There's no computer, no television yet. Saturday night, and Kleinigkeit. Later, these women became Shomer Torah Mitzvah. When their children came home from day school and said, Mama, you're embarrassing me, and what a woman will do for her children. At times, it's a lot more than what she'll do for her husband. Just think. And they took the Rebbe to the West Side, the famous story, the hotel. And the Chassidim told him, Rebbe, you're old, you're tired, you had a stroke. We have a nice place in Lakewood, Dafka. There was a hotel owned by people of Chabad origins. We want the Rebbe to live there, and once a month we'll come out, we'll make a farbrengen. And the Rebbe woke up the next morning, and he said that, listen to me, my Taira Chassidim, my dear Chassidim, from Abu Uchkum, where I come from, Rebbeim tell Chassidim not to do, and not vice versa. And ich will weisen, that America is nicht anders wie die alte Heim, that America is no different than the old home. And as you know, the Rebbe said, give me a few weeks to rest up. He appointed a committee. I know some of the people who were on the committee. Pick out the wealthiest area in New York. And they, how did they pick out Crown Heights? I told you, because the biggest conservative temple was there. Excuse me, Brooklyn Jewish Center, which today is Chabad too. And the Rebbe began. But you see, the Rebbe began was very different. He began with outreach. This wasn't Satin, it wasn't the square. It wasn't just Bavav. You take in Israel, Ger, Bells. They're just concerned with themselves. They want to recreate, they want to be sure they can restructure themselves. The Rebbe began immediately with this tremendous outreach. I have some of the publications out of the early 40s. They run the comic strip, you remember, on baseball, where they have Pee-wee Goldberg, I think his name. It's a takeoff on Pee-wee Reese of the Brooklyn Dodgers, and how he comes and he puts on tefillin. And you see right away, how do you classify them? They're not Haredim, they're not YU, they're unique. And then, of course, you come to the seventh Rebbe. And here already you have an individual, as I stated, on the marathon for Svitami, if you listened to it 2 weeks ago, I think it's on YU Torah now. I don't know if this part reached it, but you have the Rebbe who Rabbi Atten Steinsaltz declared him to have Ruach HaKodesh. No one else wrote that about the Rebbe, not Rabbi Miller, Chabadnik, not Rabbi Tlushkin, they all wrote biographies. No one else wrote that the Rebbe had Ruach HaKodesh. Rabbi Atten Steinsaltz, you would consider the most modern, the most up-to-date, the most westernized, the Rebbe had Ruach HaKodesh. And this Rebbe, the thoughts that he developed, come on, no one else thinks like this. Someone will come to me and say, well, Rebbe, I have a question. My friend so-and-so, he's not religious, he's a chiloni. He's a chiloni. So, I'll get hysterical, he's a chiloni, he's what, he's a machal shabbos, I'm going to slap his face, do this, do that. You come to the Rebbe, the Rebbe, you say he's a chiloni, the Rebbe will slap your face. Vi retman, I say, how do you talk like that? This is a ben Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Look at the yichus he has. Look who he is. How do you speak that way about him? And you see what the Rebbe, shluchim, all over the world. How does the joke go? Wherever you wind up in the world, you're going to find a Chabad house and cans of Coca-Cola. No, is it true or not true? Remember I told you the story, my son-in-law has to go to South Korea, Seoul, right? Is that South Korea, am I right? It's on government business, this is not private. And he writes to the ambassador, and all right, my son-in-law is who he is, he gets an answer. Today, by the way, the ambassador to South Korea is a Frum Jew. He's the son of a YU Musmach. Akiva Tur is the son of a Rabbi Turk. Wow, what a world. And he writes to him, and the ambassador contacts him and says, I have good news and bad news. The bad news is I contacted the American Army in South Korea, and the rabbi here is a reformed rabbi. He doesn't know what Kashrut is about and Shabbos is about. The good news is, the week before you're supposed to come, Chabad is opening in South Korea. And I'm going to put you in touch with the Chabad rabbi coming in. And lo and behold, my son winds up in South Korea. And he made the minyan that Shabbos. He was number 10, came to the hotel, Shabbat, Kashrut, everything arranged. This is Chabad. What an influence they have. But Chabad is above everyone. It's not Agudat Yisrael, Mizrahi, YU, Satmar, Square, Bavav, whatever you have fits in with Chabad. Chabad, every Jew, Ba'asher Hu Sham, religious, irreligious, going to be religious. And then what Chabad introduced, the outreach, the kirov, who would ever dream that this could take place in America, have hundreds of thousands of Balei Tshuva? If I can quote Rav Pinchas Mordechai Teitz, Rav Teitz said when he came to America and you walked into a house and you found Sfarim, you could be certain they belong to the grandfather. Maybe the grandfather's alive, maybe he's not, but this was his Shas, this was his Rambam. Today, when you walk into any home in the United States and you find Sfarim, they belong to the grandchildren. This is what happened in America. And we all learned from Chabad. Remember, YU did tremendous outreach. At one point, they were very big in outreach. Torah leadership seminars, Abe Stern, these were giants. But Chabad began. NCSY, what NCSY accomplishes, Ashrei Ayin Ra'at Hazod. I can tell you over the decades on a collegiate level and even in the Kollel, some of the best students that I ever taught were NCSY products. And no background, NCSY, high school, in the Kollel as well. I start to remember names. Wow. And then who began it all? Where did it begin? Who gave us this confidence? How did we know we can reach out to people? Look at Chabad. Look at the Rebbe. Look at the sixth Rebbe. Look at the seventh Rebbe. And look how they survived. When all is said and done, I remember what everyone said about Turo after Rabbi Dr. Bernard Lander is called to his heavenly reward. What will be? No? Who is more powerful today? Who is more financially solvent? YU or Turo, Lander, and all their institutions? This is before Corona, but even with Corona, I've checked out. They're alive and kicking. Lubavitch, everyone said, what will be after the seventh Rebbe? And take a look where so many years later, and vibrant, and shluchim, and Chabad, and a message, and understanding, and outreach, you have to bow your head. And as I said yesterday when I dedicated this shiur to Rav Avin Steinsaltz, never forget that image. Here are three Chabad Choshev Rabbanim, among them Lamdonim Mufakim, sitting in a shtibel in Katamon, not far from where Chaim Maltz lives today. And a kid walks in jeans with long red hair. And they're makariv, this kid, their letters from the Rebbe. They write to the Rebbe what to do with him. And the Rebbe writes back, take him out of his environment, send him away to a Chabad yeshiva. He winds up in Chabad yeshiva. And who was that? Rav Avin Steinsaltz. And when the Rebbe meets him for the first time, the Rebbe is overwhelmed. He says, as a sachme, he's much, much more than they told me he is. He was overwhelmed who this kid in jeans with the long red hair, what he became, Zeicher Tzadik Livracha. So, to reiterate, giving you a good introduction today, there are big changes after World War II. It's not Yesh Me'ayin. Don't take the attitude, and I've been asked this question so many times by well-meaning people who listen to my, I have a lot of Talmidim in this world as well. Satmar and Square, Bubbub, etc., Lakewood. Now, the well-meaning people, yes, there was Yiddishkeit in America, there was a structure in America, there were yeshivot in America, there were some day schools in America, there were rabbanim in America, but it doesn't compare. What happens after World War II, let's put it this way, when you walk into the building here, they take your temperature. So maybe in America, we recognized 15% of our potential. After World War II, it went from 30 to 50 to 70. Today, who would ever dream a time would come when Torah Judaism, everyone looks up to it in the United States. This is our future. This is our tomorrow. Take an example, vice presidential candidate, Goya, married to a Jew, Mamala, garnished mit garnished. But take a look at Kushner, the president's family, other famous Jews, political success, etc. Room that even the New York Times has to write about Shabbat and Kashrut. And all this, you have to give credit. What the immigrants did after World War II, they raised the entire level, the entire consciousness of Torah Hashem Tamima. We're not finished. We'll pick up exactly where we left off. Be'ezrat Hanotein Layav Koach. Mori, are you there? Next week, you're going to work out Sunday. Yomo, you're listening? You work out Sunday with Yomo. And Monday you'll handle. And it worked out well. You were able all to hear me. I was able to teach from the classroom.
Yeah, everything was very clear.
Okay. What do you want to call today's lecture? The impact of the refugees post-1939. Okay? Impact of the refugees post-1939. You want to open it to questions? Are there any...
Don't stop the recording.
Okay.
And then...
The recording has stopped.
Okay. Rabbi Rakepit, the butcher's name was Grunschbech.
Grunschbech was the butcher. How do I get...
In Washington Heights.
Uh-huh. And one second. Hyman, how is that in my mind, the other names, the other name I mentioned? Is that...
Hyman and Amos, I think it was. A.B. Hyman and A.B.?
That was from Boston. That was from...
Washington and Hyman.
Or Washington Heights, too. Anyway, I have to check with the lady. Grunschbech, I remember, yeah. And there was...
Yeah, Grunschbech was definitely, he made the Auschnitz.
Aha. And I remember there was a bakery, a famous bakery we all went to.
Heisler.
Wow. Charlie, does any of that exist today?
No. Heisler has a small little commission bakery, but it's not what it was.
Uh-huh.
It's all full of Puerto Ricans and whatever.
Yeah, I know. In Washington Heights, there's one store that has big kosher sign engraved on top of it, but it has nothing to do with kashrut today. It's a holdover from what once was. I know in the Key Food, there's a Key Food there that carries kosher products for them at their request. For money you get honey, which is part of the American dream. Are there any... Yeah?
Dr. Kranzler was in Baltimore. He was in TA. It was an unbelievable school in his time. It was presumably the best yeshiva high school in the United States during his time. And as his Rebbe said, he was very much involved and was Satmir. Our senior trip, we went to New York over a weekend, and he took us into a tish to the Satmar Rebbe. We walked in, everyone moved aside.
Wow.
Dr. Kranzler is here, he brought us straight in.
Wow. His doctorate on Williamsburg is fabulous.
Right.
The new School of Social Research, it's sociology. I knew him personally, I taught his daughter, and I knew him personally. We met quite a few times. He gave me other books that he wrote. He was a very, very unique individual. That was the heart of Theravadas. You didn't find them better than the Alex Gross, than George Kranzler. There's a whole slew of people that were one of a kind. But interestingly, their children all wound up in YU. You follow Theravadas as it moved after World War II more to the right, the more open-minded graduates, one by one, you see, I'm absolutely right, they wind up in the greater YU atmosphere.
His kids grew up in TA in Baltimore.
Is Ellie Kranzler
in Baltimore? Was that?
Is Ellie Kranzler the son?
Yeah. Ellie Kranzler's his son.
All right, I want to thank you very much for joining me in honor.
Harris Posen was chair of physics at YU.
He was in physics, not chemistry. And he was a Litvisher. You remember him?
Right. We went home together a couple of times. I had him for physics course.
He was a Mira Talmud Chacham, I remember.
And his brother was a Dayan, I believe.
Where? In Washington Heights? There was a Rabbi Pons.
And one in England. I'm not sure.
Oh, in England. It could be. Because I think the Charlie, was it Posner or Posner, the one in Washington Heights? Dayan.
The Dayan Posen.
Posen.
He's still there.
He's still there. And was he related to Peretz, to the physics teacher?
He was the brother.
No, there was a Dayan too in England.
Yeah, for West Side.
Wow.
It might have been related. I don't remember. I know other people who know them. And those people related to Rav Weiss, who's gave the Yeridesh here.
Rav Yosef Weiss. Well, Rav Yosef Weiss married into the German community.
He's from California. They live there and in Denver. And they're related. There's some connection. I think they're Machatanim of the Posens. Who are on the west side.
I wonder, Rav Weiss's children, I imagine they're all in the greater Lakewood world. I remember meeting one of them at the Kotel in the 70s. And, all right, that's the generation has moved on. And they're well, like, it's enough.
Find out.
None of us say that. Find out if you can, let me know. All right, I want to thank everyone for participating, and Be'ezrat Hashem, we should be able to work it all out. And again, I remind the Koyla students, see that you're registered with Sherry, so you'll get supplementary rabbinic credit. And until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'danya. Thank you. Okay, let's see. We got to let this room now be set up for... Wow.
What's wrong? What?
Now, can you always get onto this on this computer? In other words...